So, good evening. And this evening I'd like to talk about one of the more famous, or not maybe famous, one of the important lists of qualities of mind or heart that hopefully get developed as a person cultivates mindfulness practice. And this is the list called the Seven Factors of Awakening. And shortly before the Buddha died, he had a gathering of his monks, and he gave them a short talk. And you would think that, and he knew he was going to die. Actually, part of the little talk was his announcing that in the next few months he was going to be dying. He was an old man. And so he knew his time was up. He had very few months left. So this was maybe one of his last chances to speak to these particular monks. So it's important teaching. And he said to them that he gave them a very short talk about what he had discovered in his own spiritual quest, his own process of getting enlightened. So what did he discover? So you think this is quite important. You're going to get, you know, the great truths of Buddhism. And what he does, what he said, was not truths. He didn't say a creed or belief, but rather what he said he discovered were particular qualities of mind or heart and particular practices. That's what he lists. He listed a whole bunch of these, a whole bunch of these numbered lists. He listed the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four roads to success, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven factors of awakening, and the Eightfold Path. And so in that list, in all those lists, one of the lists is the seven factors of awakening. So I find this very interesting that rather than talking about a belief or a creed, which in the West we often associate religion with, the Buddha wants to emphasize at the end of his life particular practices, particular qualities of mind that arise as a person practices. So what are these qualities of mind? There are seven of them. And the first one is mindfulness. The second one is called, usually translated as investigation. The third is energy. The fourth is joy. The fifth is tranquility or calm. And the sixth is concentration. And the seventh is equanimity. So, now it's said that the last six of these arise kind of naturally out of the cultivation development of mindfulness practice. So you don't have to be concerned about cultivating the others so much, but they kind of come in the wake of doing mindfulness practice. And the way to explain this, perhaps, is some of you maybe can think of some discipline you've developed. It could be something as simple as, you know, if you decided to develop a running practice, you're going to run for, you know. And I remember many years ago when I took up running, I didn't like it at first. And there was this tremendous inner protest. As soon as I started, you know, just making it the first 100 yards was quite an accomplishment because I just felt this tremendous resistance in my body. Don't do it, you know, you have better things to do, you have a book to read. And and then once I got past the first, you know, 100 yards or so, and then little bit I got into it more. But then I get tired and I got distracted and my body wasn't quite into it and I got sore and it was quite a bit, you know, to get into it. But as I did it every day, doing it every day, then over time, the resistance to it, the distractions I had about it faded away, and my ability to kind of enter into the flow of the running happened more and more easily. My breath improved, so I could, you know, the breath was there supporting it. I had the oxygen I needed. The muscles got stronger and limber and all the things that had to happen. And after a while, I found that it was I could really get into it. and really apply myself, really be present and almost interested in how what was going on, I could have a lot of effort and energy. You know, sometimes when you get into the flow of something like running, there's kind of an effortless effort that happens. I mean, you're expending a lot of energy, but it's kind of like effortless to do it. And then I started to really enjoy the running. There was joy in it. It was kind of delight to get up there and to feel the body moving, and you know, it just felt like everything was kind of going along harmoniously. Whereas in the first week or weeks of doing it, it was like things weren't so harmonious. It was kind of scattered, fragmented mind and body. And then I noticed that as I kept doing it, that certainly it tended to calm me down quite a bit. That a lot of the agitation of the day tended to fall away as I kind of got into the routine of it and getting involved. And in fact, I also got concentrated. You know, I get really, really present for the simple activity of just running, the physical activity, the legs running, the feet touching the ground, what was required as I was running up hills and things like this. And so there was concentration also involved. And then I would say, I can't remember this so well, but my guess is that there was also equanimity. That, I had a certain kind of balance of mind. Maybe on the uphills I would stay balanced, equanimous. Downhills I stay equanimous. And I just kind of stayed kind of just steady. Maybe part of equanimity perhaps here is just a steadiness. Just stayed steady with how it was. And some days, you know, I was in better shape. Some days I was in the worst shape. And I just kept it up, this kind of steadiness. You know, I kind of knew that just to do it and not get caught up in my likes and dislikes, my preferences. So here, what was required, though, was holding steady, or holding to doing the running practice. I had this practice to do. I just had to keep doing it. And in doing it and doing and doing it, the various physical and psychological factors in my body started to kind of harmonize or line up together with the running, and running became, and then as they lined up, all these other wonderful qualities began to arise as well. So the same thing happens with mindfulness. If you hold to the practice of mindfulness, and this is what you're going to do, and you're going to keep doing it on a regular basis, then perhaps the first thing that happens is you protest. I have better things to do. You know, I have books to read and refrigerators to defrost. And so please, there's more important things here. And or perhaps this is a lot of restlessness, or there's a lot of, there's a lot of agitation, or a lot of strong, anxieties about certain things. Or maybe there's a lot of inner conflict that you actually don't want to have to look at. And so initially there's a lot of stumbling blocks that might actually encourage a person to give up their meditation practice or their mindfulness practice because it's difficult. Just like starting to run is difficult, or maybe almost any discipline at all. So there has to be somehow working through that, and there has to be enough understanding to know to expect that as part of the path, and to know that you have to kind of go through that initial period. When people take up something like running, most people expect that it's not going to be easy right away. And so it's something you have to train and develop, and over time your lungs develop and different things develop and it becomes easier. So same thing with meditation, you have to keep doing it. And part of the beauty with some of these disciplines we can do is that some of the development that happens within us that allows us to have proficiency in the discipline doesn't have to be engineered by us. Like, we have to just keep doing the running, and we don't engineer intentionally, actively, how the lungs are going to adapt so they can give us the right amount of oxygen. That just kind of comes along. So the same thing with the meditation practice, some of the changes, inner changes that are going to happen that allows us to kind of get into it will happen kind of on its own, or the body, the mind kind of has its own inner wisdom that comes into gear and kind of becomes supportive or lines up with the practice. But you have to keep doing it. Your job is to keep running. Your job is to hold to the mindfulness practice, knowing that there are, at the beginning and at other times as well, there's going to be difficulties. And your job is to keep doing it. And then as you keep doing it, things line up. One of my little sayings that I kind of like is from that movie, The Field of Dreams, where some guy has this dream to build a baseball field, and the idea, in the middle of nowhere, and his belief is, or someone says to him, build it and they will come. So it seems crazy to build a baseball field, but he builds it. And then these, if I remember the movies, baseball players from the past who are long dead somehow materialize, and they play this great baseball game. So build it and they will come. So partly in meditation practice, you know, you're building it. You're building a posture. You're building a presence of mind. You're building a certain kind of engagement with the present moment. And then something can come. And eventually something beautiful will come. And this is what the seven factors of awakening are. They're beautiful qualities. When they get kind of awakened within us, it's considered to be the crown jewels, some of the crown jewels of Buddhism. It's kind of the inner lifeblood of the Buddhist tradition. In fact, there are some writers of Buddhism who have made the point that there are many different schools of Buddhism with many different beliefs. However, what they and all these different schools of Buddhism make kind of like a tree with all these branches that kind of branch out from the main trunk, and all these different schools on the edge of the branches. But the sap that runs through the whole tree, that keeps it all flowing, keeps it alive, is the seven factors of awakening, are the seven factors of awakening. So we get the sap running through us. I mean, it feels really wonderful when that happens. And it comes in the wake of just doing the mindfulness practice. So the first one is mindfulness. And mindfulness is, in this list, is considered a very relatively simple practice of staying present for something, or holding something in the mind. So having a presence of mind, an awareness of what is happening in the present moment. And so if you want to be mindful of your breathing, you hold your breathing in mind. You don't let your mind float away. You don't get distracted from the breathing, but you actually have the ability to have a presence of mind that stays present for the experience of breathing. If you want to be mindful of your feet as they walk, then you hold the experience, you hold your feet in your awareness. You have a presence of mind and sense, in a sense, in your feet. And you kind of let the experience of the feet kind of fill your awareness, fill your presence, fill your mind, fill your attention. You have the ability to hold it there. Not so different than, if you've memorized a long poem. In order to recite it, you have to hold it in mind. You have to bring it to mind and hold it there. So with mindfulness, we bring to mind the present moment. We bring to mind some aspect of the present moment, and then we hold it. We hold ourselves there. We stay present there with that experience. That's what, in essence, is one of the primary qualities of mindfulness, to hold something in mind. And it's a training to do that, I think, as many of you know, because often the mind maybe wants to hold a lot of different things in its mind. And mind has a mind of its own, and the mind wanders off into thoughts, into concerns, and your ability to choose where the mind stays is often not very good. And so the mind wanders off, So part of mindfulness practice is maybe not like running practice. Sometimes it's a little bit like taming a wild horse. And you have to kind of use, there's one technique I think of taming wild horses where you tie them to in a long rope to a post, and they run around and gallop and do whatever they're going to do, but they can't get away. They can just run in circles around this post, and eventually they calm down and slow down. And a little bit that kind of mechanical approach also works for our own minds. The post can be the breath. We're just going to stay with the breath. And the mind's going to go wild sometimes. And you come back to the breath, You let the mind go wild, come back, and then you eventually the mind will calm down and settle down. Partly sometimes because it gives up. Partly because you're beginning to understand the mind more and more. You don't really know how wild the horse is, perhaps, until you've tied it to the post. And then you see how strong it is. Maybe it breaks the rope sometimes. You get a stronger rope. So you learn a lot about the horse that you wouldn't learn by tying it down. When you try to keep the mind focused in the breath, you learn how out of the control the mind is, how fast it is, how much it's spinning around. You learn sometimes much better what the mind really is concerned about. It's kind of hard for many people in normal life to really see carefully, notice what their mind is really concerned about. Or how often it's concerned about the same themes over and over again. But when we try to keep the mind on the breath, that highlights, shows much, much more what is going on in a way that, you know, that is helpful. So as you see what's going on better in the mind, then you can start making some choices in the mind to let go of those things. You can develop some understanding and wisdom about maybe some of those concerns you keep getting thinking about over and over again are not so useful for you. And the mind begins to lose its interest or its fascination with certain kinds of preoccupations. And as you let go of it, it's easier to settle down. Also, as the mind focuses again on the, breath, you're taking the energy of the mind and you're feeding it. It's like energy, attention is kind of like food. And where attention goes feeds what you pay attention to. So if you're constantly paying attention to your anxieties, in a sense, you're feeding those anxieties. Or as some people would say, you're developing a habit, strengthening those, that preoccupation. If your mind goes regularly towards the breathing, you're strengthening capacity to be present. So this wonderful, this very important activity of the mind of attention is like food. And we start taking some responsibility of where we feed it to. So we start feeding it towards something like the breathing, to something healthy, helpful. Then that reinforces that and strengthens that. And there's less energy available for anxiety, for distractions, for preoccupations. And as the less food becomes available, they get weaker and weaker and weaker. And that's one reason why with time it becomes easier to stay focused on the breathing. But also, as we get into the breath and hold it there, then these other factors, six factors or seven factors of awakening, kind of begin lining up and joining forces. And they become the companions, the support for the ability to stay present. It's not so easy to stay present, so it's nice to have support. And so there's a mutuality. You give yourself the practice, you keep doing it, and then build it and it will come. So you keep doing it, and then these other qualities begin kind of joining in. They show up. One of the qualities is investigation. And investigation has this double aspect where it's both something that can arise somewhat passively as we keep doing the mindfulness, but it's also something we can actually choose to bring up and apply ourselves more. Some people call investigation curiosity. That you're curious about what your experience is. Once you're able to hold your mind in the present moment with your present moment experience, then there's a curiosity. What is this experience? What's going on here? Once you start getting into running on a regular basis, you get over the initial hump, then perhaps you get curious about how you move your legs and how you land on the balls of your feet and you know, all kinds of little kind of details you get curious that would help you run more effectively and more efficiently. So as you do this mindfulness practice, we start looking and investigating, what is my experience? What's going on here? What is the nature of my distraction? What are the hindrances that operate? What is actually pain? I keep having this physical pain, perhaps, when I sit. And so rather than reacting to the pain and resisting it or something, there's a curiosity. What is this? What really is the experience of pain? And it's a radically different thing to be curious about something than it is to be upset about something. It's very different to investigate something than it is to congratulate yourself for it being there. Just this curiosity, what is this? Let's look more carefully. Let's find out. So the second factor of awakening is this curiosity, this interest. The third is joy. And it's sometimes said, and I think it's, you know, certainly been my experience, seemingly been my experience, that as I investigate and get more involved, the next thing is energy. Because as you get more interested, more curious, there's energy there. Because you know, you apply yourself. You're kind of looking more. You know what's going on here. And so there's an increase of energy, of application, of engagement with your experience. So rather than having to force yourself to be present, there's now energy that wants to be present. You actually, there's a flow of interest, of energy. Okay, this is what I want to do. Make it easier and easier as this energy goes. With that flow of energy, with that flow of interest and energy, then there starts to be the arising of some kind of well-being, some what's called usually joy, some delight. And it's not such a strange thing, because I think many people, hopefully all of you, have had some experience in your life of being really interested in something and really absorbed in something interesting, and in being absorbed, feeling some sense of delight or joy or happiness from that well-being. Some of you maybe have the experience of reading a really good book and just get absorbed in the world of the good book, and it has a good feeling, that kind of absorption. Or some people have crafts that they do and hobbies or something, and or play a musical instrument or something, and part of the joy of doing this is that engagement, or the joy arises out of this full engagement of what you're doing. I used to enjoy taking my final exams in college because I didn't always do well. That was besides the point. But I prepare a lot. You know, I memorize all these lists and all this stuff I had to do. And then I'd show up to take my exam, and I would just get completely engaged in the process of doing the exam. And everything else would drop away. All my other concerns and worries and everything would drop away. Just the exam, and doing as fast as I could. And I felt really happy somehow. You know, it wasn't like I was happy with the exam. In principle, I wasn't happy taking it. The idea of the exam didn't make me happy. But the actual doing of it, it was the activity that I enjoyed. And I'm someone maybe it's one of my little strong points, is that I tend to enjoy the activities I decide to do. So I really, once I start to do something, I really want to do it and do it, just be involved in it. Sometimes it's a little bit hard when I'm supposed to be doing other things, because I just kind of like I'm involved in this right now, so I just want to do it. So sometimes it's a little bit of a problem. One good quality of this kind of just enjoyment of engaging and having the energy just involved in something is that I believe it's good, because I'm much more interested in the activity of doing something, in engagement, what's happening here and now, than I am in celebrating the results. So once I've done something, then I just kind of tend to forget about it and go on to the next thing. And that, I think it's a nice quality. You know, just, okay, what's next? So anyway, so what I'm trying to say is that energy arises, and with the energy comes joy, comes delight, enjoying what you're doing. And then, with some kind of joy and delight, there comes a sense of tranquility or calmness, a settledness, kind of all the agitation, the preoccupation, the concerns of the mind settle down more and more. And there's a kind of inner kind of tranquilization, calming effect that can happen. And we tend to feel very, very calm. That's part of the, many people associate meditation with calm. What a lot of people don't associate is that the experience of joy or happiness that comes with meditation in itself is one of the conditions for a deep, deep experience of calm or tranquility. Then from that calm, it becomes a lot easier to get concentrated. And so then in the wake of all this, then the mind's able to kind of get really focused. Not just simply hold something in the mind, but to really kind of have really be composed and focused and settled and steadied and kind of really engaged in almost like a one-pointed way, to really penetrate, to really settle, to really become, in a sense, unified in, around what we're focusing on. And the experience of being concentrated, when it's strong, is a really beautiful experience, one of the great delights of meditation. And then with strong, steady concentration, then in the wake of that, or in the, with the support of that, there comes a greater equanimity, greater balance of mind. So that no matter what happens to us, at least when the concentration, the equanimity is strong, we're not pushed around by that. We don't get upset when things don't go our way. We don't get excessively elated when things do go our way. We don't get caught up in our preferences for what we like and we don't like. There's kind of a steady balance. And the word for equanimity in the Pali, in the etymology of the word, means to look over. You have to have an overview of something. And so this idea of, you know, with a strong tranquility, All these factors are there, between strong tranquility and strong concentration. And there's a kind of a sense of having overview of the situation, the big picture of the situation, so that we're not pushed around by things. We don't get caught up in things that are basically petty or not so interesting for us. Or say it a different way, sometimes the experience can be the mind is so spacious, so vast, that it's so much bigger than anything that anyone could say to you. So someone can say something mean to you, and your mind just seems so big and so spacious. It's like, you know, if a 3-year-old kid tells you that, you know, they hate you, you know, they're usually, we're much more spacious around that than we are about our boss saying that. So, you know, just, oh, that's, you know, especially if it's your own kid. Oh, you know, well, because 5 minutes ago they said they loved you. You know, just kind of, you know, so you don't get caught up in these, you know, 3-year-old changes. So this overview that kind of has a bigger picture. And equanimity is considered in Buddhism as one of the most sublime emotional states that a person can experience. So rather than thinking that equanimity is something, some kind of bland state of indifference, equanimity is, when it's really attained, come strong, is so much more deeply satisfying than any degree of joy or happiness or calm that a person can have. Equanimity is just, you know, I like the word sublime, just really deeply, deeply satisfying. It's an emotional state as opposed to just kind of, you know, some aloofness of mind. So these 7 factors of awakening are factors of mind, qualities, that get developed and awakened as a person has this engagement. And they're factors of awakening, of liberation, because they create the conditions of the mind, makes the optimal conditions in the mind so the mind can begin letting go of what it's clinging to. And this is the direction of liberation. Buddhism is found through non-clinging. It's found through letting go of our clinging, what we're grasping onto, what we're attached to. And it's considered to be, consider that some of our attachments are very, very deeply ingrained inside of us. And some of them are so deeply ingrained that some people don't even see them as attachment, but take them as being, this is essentially who I am. I mean, this is what a human being is supposed to do. I'm supposed to have these things. They're so deeply embedded in us. So, but when you have all this, these good qualities, very strong good qualities there, you have strong ability to see, investigation, you have good energy, you have lots of joy, well-being, you have plenty of calm, pretty peaceful, you have lots of concentration, and you're very equanimous about how things are, then it's a lot easier to let go. You don't have to cling when you have all these other things going for you, right? If it's sunny outside, blue skies, it's a lot easier to leave your umbrella at home, you know, because you don't need it. So when it's sunny in your mind, you don't need to hold on to your umbrellas, you know, that we carry with us all the time. So these 7 factors of awakening help condition the mind, soften the mind, or prepare the mind, so it becomes easier and easier to let go of clinging. Once you've let go of clinging, at least temporarily, some deep, radical, temporary letting go of clinging, and you gotten a taste of what that's like, then you can start entering into a dialogue with clinging and non-clinging to see whether this is something you want to try to do more often. Do you want to try to live more often from a place of non-clinging? Or do you believe that clinging is a good idea? It was good to have that experience once, but now I have to work, I have all these things to do. I think I need to cling. It's important to cling. The clinging is, you know, necessary for a consumer society. And I want to be a good consumer, which our president has told us to do. So anyway, at some point, people enter a very interesting dialogue with themselves, or investigation in themselves, about whether or not to continue on the path of non-clinging. And that dialogue works a lot better if you've had a real taste of peace, of freedom, of liberation. So the seven factors of awakening are the support for non-clinging. As you have a radically deep experience of non-clinging, that allows us to reevaluate the life that we live and start making choices about, you know, where we put our energy, what we're doing, what's really important for us. And you might decide to then to continue on the path of non-clinging until that non-clinging becomes permanent, until you start uprooting or letting go of things once and for all, and so they don't come back and bother you anymore. And so I think all of you have had the experience, know if you look back over your life, to know that there's some things you clung to earlier in life that you no longer care about. No clinging at all. Some of you, when you were teenagers, were concerned about your zits. And most of you now, I think, would not be as concerned about going out in public with your friends with a zit on your nose like you were when you were in high school or something like that. Hopefully some of you have been liberated from certain kinds of concerns you had earlier in life. I certainly hope so. So you already had the experience. It's kind of a natural thing that happens. So what Buddhist practice is encouraging us to do is to take that movement that's much further. In a sense, the maturation process that happens as we become adults is speeded up through practice. So we don't have to wait until a natural kind of maturation and losing interest, a healthy losing interest in certain things we're clung to, fall away as we get older. But we can actually speed this up faster, and we can let go of things, our clinging to certain things, earlier and earlier in life, and then live a happier life as a result. Now, some Buddhist teachers are reluctant, a little bit reluctant, to teach about these seven factors of awakening because it can seem too idealistic, and it can seem too much like all the shoulds you're supposed to do. This is what's supposed to happen to you in your practice. And then people try too much to engineer, or they measure themselves, or they see that mostly what they're struggling with is struggling with stuff, not these beautiful qualities. And so people sometimes tie themselves in knots when they hear these kinds of teachings. So that can certainly happen. It's a danger. The advantage of knowing about them is that when you put value on things, those inner qualities, psychological qualities, those qualities have a chance to grow and develop. If you don't value it, you don't even notice they're there. They're not fed. They don't grow. So by knowing that the seven factors of awakening are important qualities to be developed in Buddhist practice, then when they start appearing within us, we can recognize them more quickly, even if they're faint. And the acknowledgement of them feeds them. The acknowledgement of them makes some space for them to grow and develop. It allows us to change. Knowing about the seven factors of awakening perhaps allows us to change a little bit how we evaluate the situation that we're in. And the human mind is almost always evaluating situations we're in. And sometimes we're evaluating it according to whether we think people are going to like us or not. Or evaluating according to the pleasure the situation is going to give us, or the lack of pleasure we don't. Or we get evaluated according to our status we get in the situation. We evaluate it according to how much money it's going to give us. We evaluate it. And there's all these different ways we evaluate things. And some of these things, ways in which we evaluate situations, are not very healthy for us. And it's really good to have other healthy ways of evaluating situations. And so Buddhism offers that in the seven factors of awakening. Is there mindfulness here? Is this a place to cultivate mindfulness? So if someone... if some car drives down the street here and has no muffler and, keeps backfiring and makes an awful noise and decides to stop right outside the street here with the engine on and the music blaring, and, it can be really unpleasant. one direction the mind can go is to be really upset with those people and start judging them. How could people drive like that? And how could people be that way? Or it can be, how could IMC people have chosen a place where there's so much traffic? Those people, they should know better. It's a meditation center. They should have, been more considered and realized I was going to come sit here they should have chosen a tranquil place, quiet place. And, what were they think these people doing? So that's one way of evaluating. Another way of evaluating a situation is, there's all this sound. I can feel myself agitated. Now let me get curious. Let's hold this my agitation in mind. Let's be present for it. That's the mindfulness. Let me be curious about my agitation. What's going on here that I'm agitated by this sound out there? So there's more, and then, this is really interesting to study my agitation, so we have more energy. And as we get into it, we start feeling some appreciation or some delight that we are investigating agitation. And then we start getting calmer. And then as we get calmer, we're able to get more concentrated. And as we get more concentrated, we're able to become more equanimous. And then we hear the car again. No big deal. So rather than getting caught up in the judgments and the reaction to the event, the practice thing is to evaluate the situation differently from the point of view of where we can make a real change, where we need to take responsibility for our own well-being. We're not taking responsibility for our well-being if we spend half an hour criticizing the driver of the car, being upset with them. We take responsibility for our suffering when we evaluate the situation from the point of view of what's going on with me. And then as we enter this world of my own experience here, then mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity becoming stronger and stronger, start appearing. They're beautiful qualities. So you should know about them. And the Buddha wanted his monks to know about it just before he died. So I think it's a good thing for all of us to keep in mind the seven factors of awakening, seven jewels. Is that clear enough? Sometimes I worry about giving talks with long lists. Hope I didn't lose too many of you tonight. So, thank you so much.